Hi everyone, Maayong Adlaw. Welcome to the final episode of Season 3, Abilities Advocacy with Roque Bukton. We are going to examine in this episode how we can be more intentional, thoughtful, and considerate to individuals in our community with varying abilities or disabilities, if you prefer. How can we also learn more about how to advocate for individuals living with disabilities in our workspaces, in our public spaces, and even within our own family and friends network. I hope that you enjoy this episode, another episode that just has opened my mind in just interacting and being more conscientious around those that I love with varying abilities and disabilities. Enjoy. Maayong Adlaw, welcome back to Philippine Exit Wildness's final episode of Season 3. I may sound a little nasally in this episode, y'all. Excuse me as I'm fighting some congestion and a cold right now. But as we get into it, I wanted to just say we did it with 3 seasons. Woohoo! I'm your host, Cheryl Sampson Ramirez. Following our last episode on healing racial battle fatigue with Professor Janet Stickman, we will be talking with the Vice Chair of the California State Independent Living Council and Peer Specialist for Painted Brain, Roque Bukton. As mentioned in previous episodes, all views discussed are for informational and educational purposes only. It's not meant to be medical advice. Always consult with your healthcare practitioner for your particular condition, especially before starting any exercise or new health program. For this episode, I'd like to welcome Roque Bukton. Welcome to the podcast, Roque.
Hi, everybody. Kulusta. Good to be with you all. Apologies for a little computer fan noise in the background. It just kicked on, so we will just have some ambient sounds.
It's all good. We all could appreciate some white noise and go, a little bit of ocean soundtrack in the background as we go through the episode. So thank you all for your patience. It is a special day. So we usually open our episodes asking where both sides of your family are from and where are you currently streaming from, Roque?
Well, my family is primarily Bisaya. So there's 3 Bisaya. I'll start with my mom's side of the family. My mom, by blood, is really Bisaya, but she was raised in Baclaran, Manila, because my grandfather moved the family from Hinonangan, southern Leyte, to Manila for work, like just prior to the war. My dad is from Hinonangan Leyte, so it's a strong kind of Hinonangan Southern Leyte connection. Just for a little clarity, there, Cebuano, Sogbuano type variant speaking, like a dialect of, so they're not Waray, like the northern parts of Leyte. I did have the fortune to be raised by my grandparents. So on my maternal grandparents, my grandfather on my mother's side is also from Hinonangan Leyte. Very strong connections there. And my maternal grandmother is from Misamis Occidental. So she also spoke Bisaya. And so I didn't get to meet my dad's parents, my paternal grandparents, but from best I could tell, they were also from Southern Leyte. So I don't have super detail on that. But and then there's connections from my grandfather's oral transmissions that his family came from Bohol a long time ago, and they migrated. So there's probably some connection to Bohol as well. So my maternal lineage is the Alas side of the family, and then my father's side is Bukdo.
That's cool. We have a connection. Like, my mom's family is from Misamis Occidental also, so we're probably related.
And so as far as where I'm located, I'm here in Tongva lands, near the river in LA, up in the foothills. So really, you know, like a beautiful area, really connected to it. And once again, thankful to be on these lands.
And that's another fun commonality. I found out that Roque lives up like walking distance from my childhood home. So that's pretty hilarious how things like that happened. All right. So now that we know your lineage, let's jump into the topic at hand, ability advocacy. Instead of using the word disability, I wanted to take a strength-based approach to this topic and title it using the word ability. So Roque, tell us about your origin story and what got you on the path towards ability advocacy.
Wow. Well, that's a long journey, and it starts from birth. So I was born with a couple of disabilities. One, I was born with a genetic disorder of my eyes, and that's called retinitis pigmentosa. And that genetic problem doesn't affect most people till they're much later in adulthood. That's very common. And RP affects the periphery of the eye, the retina. So like what most people would think of as their peripheral vision. And over time, those cells don't regenerate. And so you lose, like, there's like multiple, I don't know, hundreds, maybe thousands of pixels, so to speak, in the eye. And the retina, they just don't regenerate. And then you start getting less and less of like field clarity until now where I just have some light perception, shapes, things like that. I don't have much detail anymore. So it, like, the onset really affected me probably in my mid-30s. That's when I really started noticing things, like I couldn't see things down at, below my, like, by my feet, by my knees. I would bump into things, and, you know, and my night vision started going because, of course, I don't have the same number of retinal cells. And the other disability I mentioned I was born with a leg deformity. So my leg is crooked, my right leg. And so that kind of, like, when I was a little kid, like, when I first started walking from, like, when I could see, I saw pictures of me in, like, these orthopedic shoes. And I was like, hey, look at, I was like, why don't I have these kinds of shoes? And I asked my mom. And she said, because you had a crooked leg. And she said she would, like, try to massage my leg to try to straighten it and things like that. So it's affected my hips, of course, because there's, like, you know, balance and length, so to speak. And that goes all the way up the spine. And I have, like, neck like imbalances. It's not like a perfectly aligned straight spine like some folks have. And also had some injuries with my neck. You know, a lot of colleague and CLOT training, and it caught up with me later on in life. The other disability I have is hearing impairment, which is tinnitus, which is ringing in the ears. And that probably is, it's possible and probable, but I did a lot of music playing when I was younger without ear protection. A lot of rock and roll, punk rock, R&B, jazz bands, and then Kulintang, gong music without ear protection. And that is a likely cause, but there may be other reasons, and I'm not sure. But I have it as well. So I live with, you know, multiple disabilities. So typically I describe myself as a person living with multiple disabilities: hearing impairment, visual impairment, mobility impairment. And yeah, that's kind of how, like, my life trajectory has guided me to connect to the broader disabilities community. For the longest time, I was working in the Filipino community doing cultural work primarily, and traditional lineage practices like the Kulintang and martial arts, and studying spiritual practices and just general history about the region. And later on in life, it was a kind of a goal of mine to connect and work in the disability sector. When I first started connecting with the visual impairment community, it really did help connect me to the broader visually impaired community and having a greater understanding of that community. Much later, I wanted to broaden that connection to other disabilities, so I started connecting with other organizations that service a broader range of disabilities, not just visual impairment. And that did help me connect to the much larger community that's comprised of so many various disabilities, both physical, sensory, and mental. So that's how I got really connected into the disability advocacy.
Thank you for giving us your origin story and really explaining to us the varying abilities or disabilities that you're living with. So you've been a disability advocate coordinator and peer specialist for Painted Brain since 2021. What is Painted Brain? Let's start with that first.
Painted Brain is a peer-run mental health service provider, and they use art as a medium for some of their services. And the peer aspect is important. So it's people that describe themselves as having lived experience with mental health challenges. And a lot of the staff identify as having a mental illness. They're very open about sharing and disclosing things like that. And they do work, with social justice issues. So they, there's things of that nature, the consciousness of the folks. And they have done several projects that I've been a part of for the disability sector in particular, for mental health support services for people with disabilities. And currently they're doing a lot of training. So they're doing peer specialist trainings, justice involved trainings, psychiatric advanced directive trainings, and the disability cultural competency training.
And I understand, Roque, that you're certified in as a disability peer specialist, correct?
Yeah. So right around COVID, I decided to get that certification. I took a training at an independent living center, and I'm a disability peer specialist, and I have been doing the peer training for the Medi-Cal certification for peer specialist recently. So it's been a really good training. It's, it's primarily the cohorts are comprised of people with lived experience. And I think it's been very interesting as a disabled person facilitating trainings like that, because I'm using a screen reader and I'm trying to dissolve any kind of hindrance or obscuration of view regarding people with disabilities being able to teach and train, that we're competent, we just have a different way of navigating in the world, but the content can be transmitted. So that's been good. That's been really good.
For those of us that aren't really knowledgeable, you mentioned you use a screen reader. What is that?
So most people look at things like on their screen on a computer, for example. I can't see the text or images. So I use an application, which is the most common one in the world, which is JAWS. And it reads the screen, and I'll give you a quick demo of what that sounds like. So I'm in the recording app that we're using for this podcast. I'm just going to tab, and you can hear a little bit of how my screen reader functions.
Okay. Increase size. Actual recording is higher quality. Expand frame rock button. Expand frame button. To actual recording is higher quality. Expand frame Cheryl Sampson Ramirez.
So it's talking about what's on the screen. There's like a frame, I guess, of some kind, and our names are in there, I guess, with some settings and things like that. So I can read documents, websites, but there's challenges. There's also things that screen reader has, like there's like navigation challenges, like Gmail just recently shifted formats, and that just caused like trouble trying to navigate in it because the keyboard commands have shifted. So there are challenges. It's not perfect, you know, like there's a learning curve in how to navigate with every app. So you have to figure that out. On my phone, it's also talking. And so my phone talks using a screen reader. So there's a whole environment that the visually impaired navigate in order to access like common things like smartphones and computers and other platforms that you might encounter.
Thanks for letting us experience that example. I don't think many people who are not in your community are aware of all the different tools that you might utilize throughout the day. So let's go back to, again, talking about your disability peer special certificate. Tell us more about what that entails now that you have that certificate.
Well, it basically just, covers most of the basic support services that you might provide as a mental health service provider, with a particular emphasis on the disabilities community. So it's not like a licensed clinical social worker, MSW or something like that. It's like one step down. It's like below that, you could say. But it's getting very popular amongst mental health service providers because the clients themselves, the people themselves, they really do like connecting to someone with lived experience, meaning someone who has like a parallel life path that can relate to them without that client or peer, that person, having to explain it all. And in particular, like with people with disabilities, like if I was with a clinician who was able-bodied and doesn't understand living with multiple disabilities, it's kind of hard to, you know, transmit what that all means. And in particular, like I know there's some friends and colleagues who are deaf, hard of hearing, and they find it difficult to connect with the clinician, therapist who doesn't have the lived experience of being hard of hearing or deaf. And they you know, like they might not know how to sign and they have to go through an interpreter, et cetera. So those are sort of the things that in particular, the, you know, disability peer specialist certification covers, so that you understand like how to speak, you know, from a trauma-informed, you know, position. You understand cultural humility and cultural competence. You understand the various approaches to dealing with particular like disabilities, you know. So there's a range of like speech impairments that, you know, you learn to navigate, intersectionalities in particular, like how people have multiple disabilities. They can have a physical and a mental disability, and how they have to navigate in the world. So all these challenges, like if I'm dealing with people who are blind, we totally understand like how a screen reader is not incompatible with certain apps, and it's frustrating to navigate. You can't accomplish things. Or in the past, you know, like people would send you a flyer or something, and it's just all an image, and you're like, what's in this? What's the date? What's your event? Et cetera. There's some workarounds for all that now. I mean, and AI is definitely helping out with those sorts of things.
Awesome. I mean, I feel like it's funny that you were talking about cultural competency in a different way, because I feel like your screen reader needs to be cultural competent in pronouncing your name right.
That's also a thing too. Yeah, you get used to my name, like Rock. Like it says Rock, it pronounces my name Rock, or I've heard it, you know, like row Q, like, yes, you're seated here in aisle 9, row Q. Like things like that. It's on some level, sometimes it's fun, but on other times it is kind of difficult to hear things correctly because the screen reader, you know, I think it's just amazing. I would not be able to interface in this modern world without these assistive technologies. So yes, there are roadblocks for sure. But there's been so much improvement over time. I mean, I didn't have any of this stuff back in the past. You know, there was, we like way back when there was very few devices to help people with disabilities. So it's grown quite a bit.
I'm glad that you went also over like what a peer specialist certificate entails, because I'm sure that we have other mental health providers listening to this podcast. So it's good for them to also be aware of that certification, you know, if they also want to work with like population with like varying abilities and disabilities. So thank you for going into and explaining what that entails. Let's transition in talking about your role as a council member for the California State Independent Living Council. So why don't you maybe explain to us first, what is the California State Independent Living Council and what do they do?
Well, the State Independent Living Council of California is sort of the oversight body that looks over the various budgets and capacities and infrastructure of services for people with disabilities. And primarily, those services are provided through the independent living centers in California. So there's about 28 independent living centers for people with disabilities scattered throughout the state of California. Here in Los Angeles, there are about five or six centers, just because LA County is so big. There's like a need for like a lot of capacity. And so the council, the SIL for short, goes over like federal funding for these centers, and like how that's how like that budget is built out, like various components, various little, you know, pockets of money for this or that. And then it also looks at how the larger departments are providing services for disabled people in California. So the Department of Rehabilitation, they play a significant role in providing services for disabled people. For folks with mental illnesses, the Department of Developmental Services provides services, and particularly they provide services via the regional centers throughout the state. And then also aging, as a lot of us know that when you age, you can often end up having a disability, age-related. Various things can turn into disabilities as you age. So the Department of Aging also has a lot to contribute to services for people with disability, living with disabilities. And then there's all other different agencies, long-term support services, in-home support services, etc. You know, like helping people be able to live independently in their homes and their community. So that's that. Yeah, that's a good overview. And, you know, the council is comprised of a mixture of people with lived experience and center directors. So that's basically the SILC.
And what are some of the items that you're focusing on and advocating for currently?
I would say right now it's like long-term supportive services to make sure that there's access for people who have like conditions that are probably not going to alter over time, that that they're able to have services across their lifespan. So like, let's say a youth going to school, things like that, you know, like, so from education, and then as they transition to like college age, if they're able to access college in one way or another, maybe even remote learning programs, and then adulthood to get work, etc. And then in their, like, if they need in-home supportive services, that they're getting those kind of community-based services. That's like, that's one thing. Well, just to, you know, like, have some awareness, like, budget wise, we're always like trying to make sure that programs are people know of these various programs, that the organizations, the community-based organizations know of the funding opportunities. So there's a lot of incentives to promote different kinds of either grants or bids of contract. Also, like voter registration and actual voting, that's like a thing to help, you know, people have awareness to that who are disabled, that the voting is accessible. We track a lot of bills going through the legislature. So there's a big emphasis on keeping track of bills that impact the community. And that can be to varying degrees. It could be like budget allocations or new projects and programs. There could be very local support things, like, you know, for a specific county, things like that, transportation, all those sorts of things. So it's all kind of interconnected, whatever people with disabilities interface with. There's more than likely going to be something that we're staying on top of. The SILC focuses on advocacy. So it's more of speaking about particular issues, highlighting something. It's not lobbying. So we're not, you know, asking the legislature directly for funds, but we're saying what we can do is say this, there's an issue, you know, and that they should pay attention. I'll give you one of my pet ones. This is not a SILC one. This is just something that has come to my knowledge, and maybe it'll get some traction with the council, but about 50% of the homeless in Los Angeles, and I think this is a California statistic as well, it's about 47%, about half the people who are unhoused describe themselves, identify as a person living with a disability. And to me, that kind of makes it a disabilities issue. And, you know, so it adds another layer to the complexity of the unhoused. And so I'm hoping that in the upcoming round of legislature visits, we'll be meeting with some of the representatives and senators, that I can maybe get some attention about this being a disabilities issue as well, you know, along with the many other complexities of the unhoused.
Yeah, no, for sure. That's definitely a current thing that is on the minds of many people, especially if you're living in the Los Angeles area, right? So, you know, Roque, for me personally or professionally, I, as a social worker working within the K-12 public education realm, I've always been baffled on how one teacher could provide varying or differentiated instruction to a classroom of students with varying abilities or disabilities, as you like to also term it. So I'm also curious, with various types of disabilities out there, how do you determine what to prioritize within your advocacy work?
That's a really good question. There is a great amount of diversity of need. So what to prioritize can be challenging. Different disability sectors definitely have like an emphasis of, you know, their needs. For example, people who have mobility impairments that require in-home supportive services, that that's a real serious driver for support. There's a lot of people with mobility and visual impairments where transportation is a major challenge. So, for example, in Los Angeles, there's a pretty robust transportation system, and they have what's called paratransit.
Yeah.
And in rural areas, they don't have those services. The reason that is why rural communities don't have the same paratransit services is because of the way the Americans with Disabilities Act stipulates the service rate, it reads like this. I'll paraphrase. They'll provide paratransit service within 3/4 of a mile of a fixed bus route or train line. So if you're outside of that 3/4 of a mile distance, you're outside of the service range, according to the Americans with Disabilities Act. That might need to be, redefined.
Yeah.
Looked at, and because there's plenty of people that live outside that range who are disabled. There's a lot of people
limiting
in rural areas, and that, there's, I'm in the past, there was not the same kind of, geographic spread of where people are living. Now there's people living all over the place in rural areas, and even there's even some communities that are somewhat urban, but they don't have the infrastructure. So that's a challenge. There's so many things. I could just go on and on. There's things related to drugs that, folks are advocating for certain kind of medications, et cetera. Any number of things pop up, and that's where the advocacy takes place. You get feedback from the community. This is the thing that's affecting us, and you don't even realize it until the community explains it to you, and then you understand the dynamics. So there's things like issues about the current care court, and how is that going to affect people with mental illness? Are they going to have are their rights going to be preserved? Are they going to be forced into facilities, etc.? There's all kinds of dynamics like that that are challenging. Along with that, I'll just share that also I do sit on another council, which is the Protection Advocacy Council. The full name is the Protection and Advocacy for Individuals with Mental Illness. That's a SAMHSA, what is that? A Substance Abuse Mental Health Service Administration Federal Oversight Committee. And that's for people with severe mental illness. So those folks that have been identified as having a severe mental illness, those that might be in a guardianship, conservatorship, trust, etc. Facilities they live in, some locked facilities, the prisons, any place that someone who identifies with a severe mental illness, that committee looks at, any kind of complaints that arise in these various facilities or these people who identify as such, post complaints. So they look at those things, and they can go from, the cases could be as simple as just trying to, put a set of best practices into play at a facility so that the staff is more skilled in the way they're handling the people, and or if it's really a egregious thing and someone was really violated, then it goes into a case. There's actual charges, and things can escalate from very small courts all the way up to the Supreme Court. So it's a range of protections, as in the name. to make sure that this vulnerable population is tended to fairly and well, and not abused in particular.
Such important work, you know, that you're doing for your community, Roque. It was great to start this first half and getting a bit of a background on what you do and your advocacy work along with your origin story. Thank you for joining us all for our 12th and final episode of Season 3. I'm talking with the Council Vice Chair of the California State Independent Living Council and Peer Specialist for Painted Brain, Roque Bucton. Feel free to take a quick stretch, refill your water or tea. We'll be right back with a fun second half after this quick break. Exit Wellness, you were just listening to the Instinctual Time Travels by Jinji, released in 2011 off of her Jinji album through 623537 Records, DK. Jinji is a DJ, producer, percussionist, and vocalist. You can find her music on all digital platforms, and we'd like to thank Jinji for consent to use her track in this episode. Shout out to all our Philippine X artists and musicians out there laying down the tracks. And I just wanted to thank all of the artists and musicians out there that have given us consent to use your tracks on this, on our podcast. This is actually the last episode for a while that we'll be breaking up our episodes into halves with our musicians from our community. So I just wanted to do a special quick thank you for an acknowledgement of appreciation for all of you that have lent us consent to play your music. Returning from our break, I'm talking with Roque Bucton about ability advocacy. Now, Roque, we are a Philippine ex-Filipino podcast, so given the needs of our Filipino and Philippine ex community, let's start with, what do you feel are our priorities around ability advocacy? Where should we begin?
Well, you know, I think one of the biggest challenges that exists within the Filipino community is the shame or stigma associated with someone that has a disability. And that could be the individual themselves having shame about, you know, what their condition, and the family in particular having shame about, like, a child that has a particular disability. I think that's one of the biggest things, is to overcome the stigma within a family, to encourage them to be more open about it and support in a more, like, transparent way, and not to feel shame, because it's just a condition. You know, many people have disabilities, and as people age, they can have disabilities occur, even though they've been healthy most of their life. So it's a natural occurrence on many levels. There are extraordinary conditions, of course, but I'd say the biggest one is that, you know, like people feeling, you know, for various reasons, shame, whether that's social or, you know, like, or, you know, like in our Filipino community, there's a lot of superstition as well, connected to religious practices. Also, there can be like some, you know, superstitions related to that. And to kind of free those kinds of projections would be very helpful. And then also trying to acknowledge the load that the individual carries, you know, like the emotional challenge, and also the family's emotional load, meaning it's a lot to take on when someone has a disability individually and within a family. And to develop those kinds of support services would be really good, so that the person with the disability and their family and primary caregivers have some kinds of supports. I don't really see those sorts of things happening in the community. And I think that would be really great. I didn't receive those kinds of things, and I know that I myself would have benefited from them, and my family, my mom in particular, would have benefited from those kinds of supports, because I know it was a load upon her to hear that her child is going to go blind, you know, things like that. So,
yeah. Are you, when you say like supports for the individual with a disability and also for the family members or the loved ones, are you talking about like therapeutic support or even also how to navigate the system?
I would say primarily mental health support services, like support groups of different kinds, so that people would have a better mental state to deal with the challenge, both as the individual and with the family and their caregiving, because there's various kinds of disabilities that require different kinds of levels of effort and capacities. But yes, understanding like what sort of support services are out there, like that, you know, those kinds of, like, that kind of a network is available to the community that people can go to and say, yes, you know, I've become disabled, or I'm disabled from birth, or et cetera, or the family, you know, there's something where they're having to provide support services and they need, you know, to like find services in their area, like if those sorts of things are in place, those be beneficial in general. Sometimes just having community support in a given language could be very important. So those sorts of things, you know, are what I would recommend.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too. As you were speaking, I was thinking about also being able to provide that even in different dialects, especially since we're, you know, have so many dialects in the Philippines, would be really helpful to just have, right, for folks.
Sure. It does help to, you know, speak about things in your primary language. There's you know, emotional things that you can express much better. And there's a comfort and an ease of being able to communicate. So having a primary language support service would be very beneficial.
So, Roque, personally, how did your family navigate around your disability?
Well, I know it was tough for my mom, because she didn't really understand, because, like I mentioned earlier, retinitis pigmentosa is a genetic disorder, and then its onset is gradual over many years. So it's a course of time where your eyesight diminishes. So it was hard for my mom to understand, like, what do you mean my son's going blind? He's functional. He wears glasses, but he's getting around. He does all kinds of things, you know. And so that was really tough, you know, for her to grasp. The family was wondering what's going on. Like, what do you mean? You know, like, maybe there was something that caused it, or, you know, like, whatever, some other reasons. And, you know, trying to understand how to navigate all that was not easy for my mom. She was trying to get services, trying to help me out, but it was tough to navigate for sure. And I'm sure it was, you know, emotionally challenging, you know. And for the family, they don't know you know, they don't have the skill sets. They're not equipped like that. You know, they're not licensed clinicians or things like that. So, you know, they're coming from it from a different, you know, viewpoint. Just kind of general support. They also didn't understand what my disability was, you know, like, because I had such high function. It was difficult for sure. Emotionally for me as well, it was very challenging. You know, I did not have the emotional, skills of language to express, you know, what I was going through at that time. It's somewhat overwhelming when you're like in the midst of it all. Much later, I developed those skills because I became more at ease with my disability, had a greater level of understanding of it, and the potential that I had as a human being, and not being, thinking that my life was over because I had a visual impairment.
And as your visual impairment progressed and you began to understand more about what it entailed, how did you help your family members navigate around your needs and help them to understand what support you needed?
Well, I just by my actions, they saw that I was, independent, that I was engaged in the community, doing community work, a lot of cultural things, and that I was, you know, getting through life, basically, that, you know, I was able to, you know, do certain things, go to school, work, do culture projects, etc. And also them having more experience around me, so them understanding, like, how to guide me around, you know, so they got comfortable with that. You know, there's certain things like that goes to the, like, cultural competencies, you know, like how to approach someone, you know, who's blind, you know, how to guide them instead of them grabbing me and pulling me or things like that. And then also them understanding that I do have, like, abilities, like I can navigate in a space, a given space, that, you know, I can manage myself, you know, doing different things. And then letting them know where I really do need help, like please help me read this mail, for example, back in the day before all that screen reader things and all that. We didn't have those sorts of things. We didn't have, like, devices, like, we didn't have cell phones. So I didn't have any, you know, that high tech stuff that we have now built in the phone, that, you know, that where it could read text and things like that, or scenes or colors or identify currency, all those sorts of things I needed help with in the past. So, yeah, I think just getting, having that time for my family to get comfortable with how I move in the world, I think is one of those things. Like, you know, they understand how to guide me, you know, orient, you know, help with certain things, or orienting, etc. But yeah, that's the real life experience, the engagement with the family. That's where it really happens, and sharing, you know, on my side, like, how best to help me.
We have other mental health providers that are either watching or listening in. And you mentioned as your disability progressed that you also would have benefited from emotional and mental support in the process of it, right? So tell us more about what that emotional and mental support could look like for someone who is either a mental health provider or for someone who has a loved one that is either born with the disability or develops it in a later onset as yourself.
Sure. Yeah. So this was kind of an informal support network. So I went to service centers where there were a lot of blind folks, you know, and I was going through a difficult time because, of course, I was losing my sight in this sort of transitional phase. And I encountered, like, a lot of blind folks, visually impaired folks, that were doing well. They weren't just sad and depressed. They were happy. They were joking around. They were active. They taught at the centers. They worked at the centers. They had other jobs. They had careers. A lot of folks were, you know, entrepreneurial. It changed my perspective. So it was sort of like an informal peer support network or group. You know, I started hanging out with folks, doing kinds of projects, assisting, and just all the interaction. And so that kind of like peer support is good. Like a, you know, peer support group, if someone's a clinician, if they're, you know, are able to facilitate that kind of thing for the community, that would be of great benefit. Those clinicians that have a disability, you know, if they can highlight that they have that kind of lived experience and can support in particular sectors, you know, that would be of great benefit as well. Just going through some like general trainings, just to share what I mentioned earlier, I was part of the team. We developed a disability cultural competency training, and that was to help clinicians to understand the various nuances of providing service to the disabilities community. So things like that would be of great benefit, so that the clinicians would understand various, you know, like basic needs, you know, like how to address someone for the first time, how to interact with them, you know, very basic, like simple protocols like that. Sort of sets of best practices of how to facilitate like either therapy sessions or group sessions. Those would be all of great benefit to the community. Plus the layer of like Filipino culture competencies. So, you know, like the way people want to interact, you know, there's all kinds of cultural things where people want to talk about, you know, their life a little bit first. You know, they talk story a little bit before they can settle in. There might be like food things, you know, which is a big community. There might be like those group sessions might have to have that as part of the thing, etc. You name it, like those sorts of actual Filipino cultural competencies, you know, blended together, could really benefit the community.
And for those that are tuning in, right, from all over the diaspora, because we've checked our data and we find that there's also people that are listening and watching from other countries. If they discover that they have a loved one that was born with a disability or has a later onset, as with your own story, where do they begin to obtain support from the very beginning? What do you recommend as a starting point when you want to obtain support for your loved one?
It depends, you know, internationally, it varies over like every country. You know, America has a very developed service, you know, network, and that comes from the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is rooted in the civil rights movement. So it comes out of that, you know, it's definitely connected to those movements. So the movements for equal rights, voting rights,
segregation, civil rights. Yeah.
Civil rights, all the pioneers of the, I don't know if that's the right word, but the advocates of the independent movement are connected to that. They come out of that same kind of like grassroots advocacy, and they fought really hard to get their services. So that's the genesis of the Americans with Disabilities Act. In Europe, there's a pretty developed, you know, legal structure for people to get reasonable accommodations and services, etc. Mm-hmm. And then again, internationally, it varies depending on where you are, but you know, always go to like the very specific organizations that dealing with that disability, That's always a good go-to. If there are any kind of community-based organizations, for example, like here in the United States, we have the Independent Living Centers, and that's national. So there's always going to be like a center dedicated to serving a broad spectrum of people with disabilities. It's not just specific, so that's really good as a go-to, because they will pretty much like assist with any kind of disability. There's certain specific niches that have certain paths, like if it's a mental illness, for example, then there's like service centers for those. Also, just connecting with the actual people that have the specific disability. So if there's like a network of folks like that, going right to them, they're usually very knowledgeable themselves about what kind of services are available. You know, they'll kind of know the organizations, they'll kind of know what kind of services, you know, that you can apply for. And so I would say that, you know, in general, those are good places to start.
And for organizations, let's say nonprofits or private companies that would like to open up access for individuals with varying abilities, let's just say they're launching from the, you know, from the start, right? Where can they start to begin to create, open up access and create access?
Well, fundamentally, it would, in the United States, it would be the Americans with Disabilities Act, which covers like the various compliances that you have to have in order to provide services for someone with a disability. So from the physical location itself, like a facility, a building, a school, a community center, for example, a church, temples, etc., like how to make them more accessible physically, and also in terms of navigation and orientation. And then there's work, you know, accessibilities that reasonable accommodations can be provided for someone with a disability in order to work, and that's their right to be accommodated. In school in particular, it's really grown for education. Back in the day, I didn't have those sorts of, you know, support services, and it was much more challenging. Now education has really progressed, so, you know, understanding like the support services that a student is eligible for, those sorts of things. Beyond that, I would say really talking to the person with a disability and asking what their needs are. That's it, because if many things are affecting our community, the disabled community, that, you know, are unique to a given place, a particular, you know, situation, a particular obstacle that, you know, so I always defer to like speak to the person, ask them, you know, like what sort of services they need, and then kind of work in combination with the requirements. So there's like compliance, but there's also just like what's really working, because there's a lot of things. I'll say that there's a big difference between ADA compliance, meeting the federal like requirements, and cultural competencies. So that's the other side of it. I'd say if you have a balance between those two things, you'll be doing really well.
And when you say ADA compliance versus cultural competencies, when you say cultural competency, because I think we've used it varied in terms of definition throughout the episode. Are you talking about cultural competency related to a particular a disability, or are you talking about cultural competency also based on one's ethnic background?
In this case, I'm referring to etiquette more when I say cultural competency. So, you know, proper etiquette in interacting with someone with a disability.
Got it.
And rather than like thinking, oh, this person is blind, so he needs everything in Braille. Well,
right.
Not necessarily, because that might be a little slower for that person to use. You know,
yes.
It's way faster to use my screen reader than reading, you know, like documents in printed Braille, because nowadays they have Braille displays. So it's not even common to get a printed Braille. It's more common for someone to plug in a Braille display, which has the grid of the dots on a display. The dots pop up. per line, and you're navigating like a website or something like that. And then you're just touching the dot matrix kind of line by line, you know, however you got your display set up. And so that's Braille, or they might be reading in private, because, you know, like with my screen reader or my phone talking, anyone can hear it. So if you want some privacy, you might be, you know, reading or composing something, a transmission in with your Braille display, etc. So that's a real big difference. You know, that's happened to me. You know, I've experienced that where people wanted to help, you know, different agencies, and they're like, oh, well, there's a, you know, a blind person participating, so we have to get everything printed in Braille. And I'm like, whoa, pause. No. You could have asked me first. And then, you know, that's cultural competency etiquette, that you ask the person like, hey, what's the best way we can get you this material? Then they can share like, oh, you know, I just prefer in an accessible doc format. And I can get that either from my laptop or my phone. The screen reader can read it, you know? So that's a simple example, but that happens across multiple disabilities. You know, what's best, you know, interpreters, like the best way to interface with someone who's, you know, using sign language, etc.
Yeah, I'm glad that you clarified what you meant by cultural competency. And I could even, just circling back to what we were talking about in terms of how can we, you know, advocate more in our Filipino or Filipinx community, you mentioned shame, right? And sometimes shame or hiyaa is like a big barrier in our community. Even maybe someone might feel embarrassed to ask, you know, an individual with a disability what their needs are. So it's having to really just overcome that initial shame or embarrassment to just really start where the individual is at. So, yeah. I actually got excited, though, Roque, when you were talking about these other technological developments and advances. You mentioned even, like, as a child, where we are now technologically is such a different place, right? I mean, right now, one of the current topics that comes to mind that you mentioned earlier is AI, artificial intelligence. So, you alluded to that earlier. Where do you see artificial intelligence intersecting with individuals with varying abilities or disabilities?
There are tremendous applications and growth in that area to help folks with disabilities. And just to begin, you know, like there are concerns about AI and, you know, becoming, you know, completely sentient and then taking over. But it's appropriate use, you know, like of the tool, you know, any tool, it's up to the, you know, users, how that, you know, like ultimately what happens.
Totally.
So, you know, like for the vision impaired, I'll just start there. There's all kinds of AI apps that help read things, you know, like text and stuff like that. But it goes beyond that. It could read currency, colors. It can identify colors, but it can also identify people. So if you like aim your camera and you have like a let's say on your photos and you have things named, they could identify as, but like, oh, that's Cheryl, you know, like, because I'll put like Cheryl picture whatever, and then like if it the AI, you know, sees you holding my phone, it could say that's Cheryl in the room, you know, so you could actually have it in the room.
Oh wow,
maybe.
Yeah,
so it can do more than that. It can do like it's really developing, so like it can tell me like real time. Let's say I'm at a conference. It can identify things. It will speak things like, there's a speaker at the podium gesturing like this. There's it seems like there's a screen with text behind that person, et cetera. So, you know, if like there's like a, you know, like a kind of a PowerPoint, you know, going on. And then it can also talk about in real time, the people in the audience reacting. People are raising their hands. People responding, laughing, smiling, etc. It could talk about the decor in the room, the layout. You know what I mean? All those sorts of things. It can do scenes in the street. It can tell you you're in a landscape, your environment. You're in a park. You're in a street, urban situation. You're in a parking lot. It does all that stuff. It's pretty profound. And just in common everyday things, it like if someone sends me a picture, the AI will describe the picture. It'll say, woman seated in a chair, smiling, wearing something. You know what I mean? Like, I'm like, I never get that detail before in the past. For other folks like who are speech impaired, like with severe speech impairments, the AI is starting to learn their speech pattern and can translate. Before in the past, it had to be someone who was very familiar with that person and they had an individual translator, because you have to be so attuned to how they speak in order to translate for them. But the AI is standing in there. There's another app where, a couple of apps actually, where it's able to interpret sign language. So a deaf person can sign to a phone or camera, like let's say on a laptop, and the AI will interpret the sign language and turn it into text. And in my case, it would speak it. So it'd be turned the text into speech. So you're able to, interface. So there's tremendous growth and, you know, like in these areas. So I think of it as like just a good tool. And it's ever developing. There's just so many more layers that are just surprising at what its capacities are. You know, all those things I mentioned, I mean, years ago, what I had to look for a payphone on the street, you know what I mean? To call my paratransit. I mean, I've trying to find a payphone on the street in LA in order to call and say, hey, I like call my provider and be like, I think I'm on this corner. I have no idea because I didn't have GPS that talked back then, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, come a long way.
It's good to kind of also hear that balance and how AI can be helpful, right? Because I think oftentimes when we hear a discussion around it, it comes from a fear-provoking place. So it's also good to really hear how it may help like individuals living with disabilities and the various ways that it comes through. Especially by providing context and social cues, that's like super important, right? With various like communities like that have varying like abilities.
I just thought of that. That's really, you know, that's something that happens to me. Like I'll give you an example. Like I meet someone, they're sticking their hand out, but I have no idea.
Right.
I shake my hand. You know what I mean? So it seems like I'm being rude or something like that, but I just didn't know. But if I have my phone out and AI is running, it might say, the person is reaching out their right hand towards you. And I'll be like, oh, they want to shake hands, you know, something like that. Because some people don't have that kind of like verbal skill to say something like that. Like, you know, like, hey, do you shake hands? I'm sticking my hand out. You know, some people are very familiar with the blind just say phrases like that, you know, naturally. But unless you know to say that, it might not be, I might not know, you know, any blind person might not be able to like pick that up.
No, totally. And that's like the cultural competency piece that you were speaking about earlier. I mean, even we did an episode, talking also about supporting neurodivergent individuals. I mean, I can only imagine too how AI can also be helpful to explain tone, right? For maybe individuals, you know, that are like, that are neurodivergent to pick up on the intent or the tone behind what someone's saying. So it's pretty incredible to kind of hear the direction of where we're going as technology further develops. So, Roque, we are a wellness podcast, and we typically like to also ask our guests what their wellness routines and self-care practices consist of. And just by knowing you, I know that you're well established in this realm. So, I mean, we know that. So, what do you do for your own wellness and self-care outside of advocacy? Share that with our community.
I'm sure. Many years ago, as I was starting to lose my sight, you know, I was depressed. It was very challenging, you know, and my lifestyle just wasn't like the best. And I really started making a transformation in my personal life. And one of the things I started doing was an annual cleanse. And I'll describe this in more detail. Like every year from the Lunar New Year to the vernal equinox for Steo Spring, I go through as holistic as I can a cleanse. And that entails like just basic diet things. But as it has evolved, it's now moved to like organ cleanses. So things like cleaning the kidneys, doing kidney flush, liver gallbladder flush, colon cleanses, like heavy metal detoxes, different kinds of detoxes, you know, to help the blood in particular, cleaning the blood, doing those kinds of practices. It's, you know, I've had many, many kinds of like spiritual practices that I've practiced for many years. So meditation practices in particular, so things that were connected to Sri Visaya, that big lineage of Buddhist Vajrayana Tantra, those sorts of practices have been really meaningful to me. You know, like what most people describe as yoga is like typically movement yogas, but most of the yogas are like more meditation related. Like 90% of yoga is like meditation practice, spiritual practice. That's some of that, you know, like absorptions, you know, really studying. I like studying like the history of our spiritual practices, you know, so things that the tribes practice, I try to integrate into my life. Years ago, when I first started, part of that spiritual cleanse and journey, like I mentioned, is absorptions. And part of that is learning the actual lineages. So like studying Kulintang Gong music, that was very important to me. I'm a musician, so part of my wellness is to play music. Right now, I've just like during COVID, you know how there was a lockdown, so we were kind of stuck and there wasn't a lot of stuff going on or was very restricted. I just wanted to pick up an absorption, a practice, a study, and I picked up guitar as my choice. So I've been like shedding guitar and all that, and that's been really great because there's a very kind of completeness to that. It's music, but it requires like, you know, a practice, like the actual practicing regularly every day, and then
rocking out again.
Yeah. And doing, you know, like regular, you know, study, you know, there's like the intellectual side, the harmony and theory of stuff like that. And so the other things like that I do for, you know, like the wellness would be like exercise, movement things. So like movement yoga, as I mentioned earlier, things like just physical things, you know, whatever kinds of exercises, and doing all those things holistically. So also part of that is like detoxing. Is you know, like you're like I mentioned earlier, you're detoxing the body, but also like things that you describe as toxic. So I do things like at this time, like not listen to the news, which is such a refreshing thing to do for like a month and a couple of months. It depends on the cycle's duration, but yeah, that has a profound impact on your well-being, not listening to the news. Kind of reducing social media as much as possible because there are things that just happen because of work. And just trying to be more mindful about things, you know, allowing for like an expanse of, you know, like just to be at peace without any kind of distractions, no podcast playing, no disrespect there, but, you know, not listening to
not take eggs,
radio, you know, TV for some. It could be good. Certain spaces I might not be going to, or activities, just because it's too much activity at a given time.
Yeah.
And going to other things. So like going to meditations or like talks or things like that, like that are, you know, that assist in that. So, you know, it's evolved over time. I really think it's helped me in my wellness journey. I rely upon it. This would be my 35th year of doing it, so I've done it consistently for 35 years now. And that really I have reflected on that duration and how it's transformed over time and how much easier it is for me to do it. Before it was a challenge because of lifestyle. Now I live most of the time like this. So it's not so dramatic a shift, you know? So most of my life looks like a cleansing for the average person, or like a spiritual, you know, like practitioner. But I live like that most of the time. So it's not so dramatic a shift. It's much more natural. I would say the thing that is of emphasis would be like the internal organ cleanses. That'd be something I don't do on a regular basis.
So quieting the body, quieting the mind.
A lot of meditation practice for sure. Yeah, various kinds. There's many lineages that I practice. And so those are throughout the day happen. And yeah, it's of great benefit, you know, holistically. It has really transformed my life over time.
Awesome. Now, Roque, as we begin to close, how can our community find you if they have additional questions?
Well, I'm not the most active on social media. However, I do have an Instagram account, so you can reach me at roque.ab on Instagram and hit me up on a DM, and I'll try to navigate and get to you. I'll be more mindful about popping in there more frequently. I know my friends, post on there, and I community folks post on there. And yes, please feel free to reach out. And if you're in the community, I'm really approachable. I'm always open to, networking, connecting with folks. So like community events, please feel free to reach out.
Okay. Final words, is there anything else that you would want our community throughout the diaspora to know when it comes to supporting individuals living with varying abilities?
Well, one, that a person living with a disability can be like a really whole person. Like they just have a different way of interfacing in the world. It's sort of, I always think of it kind of like animals. Animals have their own kind of unique way. You know, they have a range of capacities and limitations. It's like that. It's like this, like I'm just my own sort of being, just like an animal has their way of being, you know. And also that, you know, that we're not hazardous to your health, that you can come up to us, talk to us, interact with us, you know, connect, you know, we're just human beings, just like anyone else. And on some level, like, just because you can see my disability, it doesn't mean that, you know, like you don't have your own struggles as well that can be as challenging as mine or even more so, just because you're an able-bodied person. So we can connect as just human beings in the journey to, you know, deal with our various ways of navigating and being, you know, well together. So I would say just connect to people with, you know, disabilities as you would anybody else. You know, I mean, you go up to dogs and just pet them, you know.
Right. And he's not giving you all the permission to pet him if you see him. Little Claire, my man. Yeah. Well, thank you, Roque, for talking to our community about ability advocacy and closing our third season. We thank you for talking to us about the importance of ability advocacy and things our community needs to consider. We look forward to witnessing your journey unfold and supporting your work and advocacy in the process.
Maraming salamat sa inyo lahat. I really appreciate the opportunity, Cheryl, to speak about disabilities. And I really do appreciate the work. Congrats on the three seasons. And props to the team that put this podcast together. And thank you to all the listeners and supporters. I really appreciate you all. Salamat lahat.
And to our community, our first episode of season 4, we're bringing that dragon energy as we talk about healing from sexual trauma with licensed marriage and family therapist, Emerald Rubio. This episode will air on Wellness Wednesday, April 17th. As we close, we'd like to acknowledge once again our guest speaker, Roque Bucton, our graphic designer and beatmaker for our opening and closing track, Richie, Jinji, for consent to use the first part of your instrumental track, Instinctual Time Travels, that you heard during our break, our advisors, Allison De La Cruz, Rian De Los Reyes, and Safo Teologo, our community partners, This Filipino American Life, SoCal Filipinos, and Trek Table, and all of our community members for your shares and support. As always, we'll share more about our guest speakers' offerings on our Instagram stories and highlights for permanent access with any of their upcoming events. Be sure to follow us at PhilippineXInWellness on Instagram, Threads, Facebook, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, and on X at PhilippineX, the letter N, well, followed by the letters N and S. Don't forget to continue to hit like and subscribe on our PhilippineX and Wellness YouTube channel. Thank you always for believing in us. Be well, everyone. Continue to take care of yourselves and each other as I continue to take care of this cold. Daghang salamat, salamat gid. We'll be right back.